to episode number one of the QICAG podcast. I'm your host, April Dinwiddie, Communications Consultant for the QICAG. The National Quality Improvement Center for Adoption and Guardianship Support and Preservation, also known as QICAG, is a five-year cooperative agreement funded through the Department of Health and Human Services Administration for Children and Families, Children's Bureau, and is designed to promote permanence when reunification is no longer a goal and improve adoption and guardianship preservation and support. Today, Dr. Mark Testa, QICAG Professional Consortium Chair and Spears Turner Distinguished Professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, is here with me to have a conversation about child welfare in the 21st century. Welcome, Dr. Testa. Thank you so much for joining us today. It is so exciting to be bringing the work of the QICAG to life via this podcast, and even more so to be doing that with you.
Glad to be here.
Great. We're going to jump right in. In an effort to set a foundation for our conversation today, it's important to put things in perspective, right, historically, with respect to the bigger picture of child welfare. And you've done this so brilliantly in some other work that you've done. Can you break down for our listeners the bigger shifts and transformations in child welfare and the root of why they have occurred?
So let's begin with a major milestone that our country reached in 2002. This is when the number of children in 4E assisted permanent homes with adoptive parents and legal guardians surpassed for the first time the number of children in 4E subsidized foster care. I should say that 4E is the title of the major federal program that funds state child welfare services. And as of 2018, there were approximately three children in 4E supported permanent homes for every one child in 4E supported foster care. This shift from family care to family permanence represents a major transformation of our public child welfare system. And it puts within reach a promise that our profession made over a century ago, and that is ensuring that every child grows up in a safe, loving, and permanent home.
Yes, Mark, and don't we wish that for all children? And with that in mind, can you give us just a bit more history here?
When the public child welfare system took shape in the early 20th century, the focus was on ensuring that dependent and neglected children who lacked parental care were adequately fed, sheltered, and clothed. And we accomplished this largely by removing children from neglectful homes and placing them in institutions or foster family care. Now, this was an important innovation. But by mid-20th century, it became evident that children needed more than a safe place to eat and sleep. They needed stable and lasting family relationships for healthy social and emotional growth. So, beginning with the passage of the Adoption Assistance and Child Welfare Act in 1980, federal and state governments put together a policy framework to reduce the number of children in long-term foster care.
So it sounds like having a framework would be critical to keeping these important promises. So how does it work exactly?
First, they mandated reasonable efforts to preserve children's safe care in their own home. And when family preservation was not attainable, they made federal assistance available to support the alternative care of children in permanent homes. Fast forwarding a little bit to 1997, the Adoption and Safe Families Act helped give momentum to these changes by setting time limits on how long children could remain in long-term foster care, and also by offering bonuses to states that increased adoptions out of foster care. Then a decade later, this is 2008, Congress added another subsidy permanency option, the Fostering Connections Act, which offered dollars to eligible kin who became the permanent legal guardians of children previously under their foster care. Now, as a result of these innovations, we can call them, the number of children in long-term foster care, that is foster care that lasts 3 years or longer, declined from 186,000 children in 1998, I have to look at my table here, to 65,000 children in 2017. So a big decline. And during the same time period, the number of children in 4E assisted adoptive and guardianship homes grew from 168,000 children to nearly 500,000 today. With these changes, I think, you know, I like to summarize it by saying that public child welfare in the U.S. is evolving. It's evolving from a 20th century foster care system focused on the welfare of children in public custody to a 21st century permanency system focused on the well-being of children in safe and permanent family care. I think that's a snapshot history of what's gone on in the last 100 years.
Oh, thank you, Mark, so much. This historical perspective is so incredibly important and gives us context for where we are and where things need to be headed. Can you also share your thoughts on the most recent commitment from the federal government with Families First and what that means for furthering services and supports for this population?
You know, so I characterize the changes in the public child welfare system as expanding the focus from foster care to now family permanence. And I believe the passage of the Family First Prevention Services Act, which becomes operational this year, creates a federal entitlement for advancing this goal. The new law enables states to use federal matching dollars for mental health, substance use, and parenting skill programs to support the permanence of family care, first by preventing the removal of children from their birth families whenever possible, and when this is not achievable, by preventing the reentry of children into foster care from their adoptive and guardianship homes. I think, you know, just as we've learned that children need permanent families to thrive in addition to meeting their daily maintenance needs, we're learning that children heal best from the trauma of neglect and abuse within the context of safe and stable family care. To promote the social and emotional well-being of children, it's not enough simply to halt the entry of children to foster care or to discharge them quickly to permanent homes. It is also necessary to address the underlying obstacles that threaten the ongoing safety, stability, and continuity of family care, both prior to entry into foster care and also after discharging them to permanent homes.
All of this makes so much sense, Mark, but I'd love to know a little bit more about how we got here and how do the new federal laws help?
The 20th century foster care system did not offer much in the way of resources to promote healing within the home. 4E funds were limited to foster care maintenance and then later adoption and guardianship assistance payments. What's important about the new law is that it opens up the 4E entitlement to help fund up to a year, 12 months of evidence-supported mental health services, addiction treatment, and in-home parenting programs, all with the goal of keeping children who are at imminent risk of entering foster care safely in their own homes. And these are homes with adoptive parents and legal guardians, relative caregivers, as well as birth parents. Now, I should conclude by saying there are some strings attached to the availability of these dollars. In order to claim federal matching funds, one half of a state's total expenditures on Family First services must be spent on programs that have been designated as well supported by research evidence. And this standard refers to replicated programs which have shown evidence of meaningful improvements in important child and parent outcomes compared to an appropriate comparison group. And because so few child welfare programs today meet this standard, it will be important for child welfare departments, voluntary agencies, research organizations to partner together to expand the supply of programs that meet the evidence standards. Fortunately, there are rigorous evaluation designs that can quickly become incorporated into existing administrative structures. And by tracking important child and parent outcomes with existing administrative data, it is feasible to ramp up the testing of promising programs at low cost to determine, you know, what works better, for whom, and under what conditions.
Well, it's so encouraging, right, to hear that there is this commitment to support families on this level, because it's indeed a need, and in some cases an urgent need, especially as we start to really understand more and more about the impact of trauma on not only children and young people, but on the entire family system. I'd love it if you could talk a bit about what we know today about the impact of trauma on children and young people, especially those that have experienced abuse, neglect, and separation from their families of origin.
Just as attachment theory from the 1950s sensitized us to the importance of permanent family relationships, neuroscience is helping us to better understand the underlying neurobiological mechanisms by which the presence or absence of stable relationships affect future social and emotional well-being. Now, when the child welfare system focuses primarily on meeting the child's daily maintenance needs, we could pretty much count on the basic functions of the brain to be operational at birth with respect to, babies eating, sleeping, crying, making a mess at times. But with respect to the higher order functions of forming attachments, feeling empathy, and developing what we call executive capacity to make good choices, the human brain is only partially developed at birth. These higher order brain functions, which actually lay the foundations for future social and emotional being, are best developed and fine-tuned within the context of safe, a stable and responsive parenting by at least one adult, and preferably with lots of support from partners, relatives, friends, and other helpers. Now, the best evidence we have for the importance of secure attachment relationships come from the Bucharest Early Intervention Program. This was a program that compared outcomes for children raised in Romanian orphanages to the outcomes of a comparable group of children placed in foster family homes. And at age four, there was credible evidence that the children overall fared better on average in families than in orphanages in terms of their cognitive, physical, emotional, social development. And because the children were chosen to be placed from institutions into foster families randomly, or you might say at the roll of the dice, the differences in well-being that we observed, or that the researchers observed, could be attributed to the experience of being placed in a family rather than to any pre-existing risk conditions that may have been the cause for their entering the institution. Now, the important qualification is that these positive differences in these well-being outcomes were sustained only if the foster family home remained intact. Follow-up assessments with children at age 12 showed that children whose foster home disrupted, they moved from that home, their outcomes fared no better than the children who were cared for in the institutions. Only the children whose foster home remained stable showed sustained improvements.
So Mark, when you think of all of this, what is the big takeaway for you?
And I think, the important lesson we can draw from this is that supportive family care early in life is crucial to healthy child development, but it's not enough. Proper healing from trauma and the adverse consequences of abuse and neglect require stable family relationships throughout childhood and into and beyond adolescence. I think this is why it is so important that the Family First Act offers funding for addressing the trauma and addressing the obstacles to family stability, both prior to foster care, but also after children are discharged to homes that are at least intended to be permanent.
Oh, that makes so much sense. And I'm so encouraged, Mark, that you touched on this idea that I often refer to as the transactional versus the transformational in terms of recognizing and understanding trauma. And that point you made about the relationships and healing being so pivotal, these elements we know, especially the building strong relationships, feel so critical. And really, when you think about it, the foundation of so many practical elements of this work holistically. I've often heard it said that complex problems require clever and creative solutions. I'd love to hear your thoughts on how the QICAG is leading the way with solutions in meeting the needs of these families today.
Happy to do that. You know, I think with the expansion of the policy focus on public child welfare, it's also important to acknowledge that we are only at the beginning stages of constructing a 21st century permanency system that can make good on the promise of promoting the well-being of children safe in permanent homes. The National Quality Improvement Center for Adoption and Guardianship Support and Preservation, we'll go with QICAG for short, is leading the way, I think, in developing evidence-based solutions for meeting the needs of children and families in these adoptive and guardianship arrangements. And it starts by raising awareness of the overall need for ongoing support and in some instances, more intensive adoption and guardianship preservation services to maintain family stability. You know, we used to think that the responsibilities of public child welfare ended when the system discharged children to adoption or guardianship homes. But as the families who accept these permanent responsibilities well know, the effects of neglect, abuse, and other childhood trauma do not automatically disappear when public custody ends. The needs of both caregivers and children for ongoing support do not suddenly vanish. In fact, I think, you know, the need for support and help actually intensifies once the foster care system relinquishes legal responsibility. Fortunately, I think most families have friends, relatives, and other sources of informal support to address the challenges. And I think this is where the QIC system, QIC center can be important, because some small set of families will need more intensive services to address the challenge. And the way QICAG can help is first by making social workers, educators, physicians, as well as adoptive and guardianship families aware that help and support exists where the need to arise. And second, I think they can promote this overall goal by strengthening through rigorous evaluation the evidence base for existing services, as well as those yet to be discovered. I mean, three of the outcomes that the QICAG has set as priorities are, one, increased family stability after adoption and guardianship. Two, improved behavioral health of children. And three, improved child and family well-being. These are pretty much the same outcomes that we can expect a 21st century permanency system to set as goals. And supporting children in a permanent family to which they feel they belong, feel they are valued, and feel that they are wanted is the first step. Helping caregivers retain a sense of self-efficacy and confidence to overcome the challenges when they arise and access support when needed without shame or undue hardship, that's the next step. And these are the pillars of child and family well-being upon which a 21st century permanency system will be built. And I believe the work of the QICAG is helping to lay the foundations and leading the way towards developing the evidence-based solutions for addressing the needs of children and families after adoption and guardianship.
So encouraging, right? And I want to thank you so much, Mark, for your commitment over the years to children and families, and most certainly for now your additional commitment in the contributions to the QICAG. In listening to you, I can't help but be encouraged and inspired by your perspectives related to some of the more urgent issues within child welfare today. And I want to just thank you wholeheartedly for being with us and sharing your really, really profound perspectives. They mean so much. So thank you so much. And thank you for all you do. Appreciate you.
Okay, April, thank you for that opportunity as well.
As we close out this first episode of the QICAG podcast, and with so many urgent needs and concerns facing us, it's both inspiring and hopeful to get a better understanding of the needs of child welfare in the 21st century. While the idea of supporting families who provide permanence seems simple and straightforward, doing this well truly does require a high level of commitment and doing the deep work to uncover and provide evidence-based solutions. Today, given the substantial increase of children supported through federally funded adoption and guardianship subsidies, it's more imperative than ever that we continue to support these families, not only as they transition to adoption or guardianship, but also throughout their journey. Stay tuned for more episodes from the QICAG. The QICAG is funded through the Department of Health and Human Services Administration for Children and Families Children's Bureau. Grant number 90CO1122-01-00. The contents of this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the funders, nor does the mention of trade names, commercial products, or organizations imply endorsement by the United States Department of Health and Human Services. This information is in the public domain.